Hello, folks. Welcome to the February 25th, 2012 edition of the Illinois World Labor Hour, brought to you over the air by WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, Illinois, and streamed live worldwide at WEFT.org. The views and opinions expressed during this hour program are those of the speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of WFT's management, board of directors, or of Prairie Air Incorporated. Now, here's Tom to acknowledge some of our underwriters.
This hour of programming is brought to you in part by Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union and community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month. For more information or for the unemployed and underemployed helpline, call 217 area code 469-6111. That's 469-6111. And this hour of programming is being brought to you by you listeners of WEFT and by the Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way. The Brotherhood of the Maintenance of the Way employees are proud to continue their support for the Illinois World Labor Hour. A democratic union, the BMWE, celebrates the voice for labor on WEFT. It is our hope that all workers may share the same benefits that they enjoy, such as living wages, job security, away-from-home expense pay, early retirement, Canadian-style health insurance, and guaranteed year-round work. And the Illinois World Labor Hour is supported in part by you listeners of WEFT and by the AFL-CIO of Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois.
Thank you, Tom. I'm your host, David Johnson, here today with Coach Tom Thomas, who will have some workers' interest news for us. And later in the show, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner. Tom's brand new poem for this week is entitled, What Recovery? Also here with us today is co-host Bob Pelesny, co-host and founder of the Illinois World Labor Hour, Bill Gorell, co-host Pat Simpson, and we have a couple of special guests today, Gene Vanderport and Jim Eyman, and we're going to be talking about, or they're mainly going to be talking about SDS back in the 1960s and some of the parallels to the Occupy movement today and what lessons the Occupy movement can learn from some of SDS's successes and mistakes. So here's Tom to kick off this week's edition of Workers' Interest News.
Champaign City Council members unanimously agreed to offer up to $3 million in tax rebates to the developer of a proposed nine-story hotel to see the project get off the ground. Deputy City Manager for Economic Development Craig Ross said that he and other officials are tired of hearing people ask when they will find something to fill the hole left when the Metropolitan Building burned down at the junction of Church and Neal and Main Streets in 2008. Now they have an answer. Planning Director Bruce Knight said that installing a hotel in the city center should be a top priority. Knight said successful downtowns have employment and entertainment in bars and restaurants, and they have residents, making it a 24-hour downtown, and almost inevitably they have a hotel. Hans Grotelucian of YG Financial Group asked for the tax incentive from the city to build the $28 million hotel, which includes plans for 145 rooms and 145 new parking places. For 7 years, the city would reimburse the developer for the food and beverage tax, property tax, and hotel motel tax dollars it pays to the city. Officials only have approximate figures of how much that might be over the course of the 7-year agreement, but they have capped the tax rebate at $3 million. Bob?
Thanks, Tom. Echoing the 2008 sit-in of the Republic Windows and Doors Factory in Chicago, a group of workers again locked themselves inside the plant, which was now run by Sirius Energy. The company has said it was shutting its operations, and workers occupied the plant demanding the possibility of keeping their jobs. Vicente Rangel, Armando Robles, who's the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers of America Local 1110 president, and Leah Freed were among the 65 workers and union representatives banding together at the company called Sirius Materials. UE Local 1110 members took over the Sirius Materials plant on Thursday after being told by local management that the factory would close immediately. When they were confronted with the same news in 2008, workers voted unanimously to occupy their workplace, guarding the machines at the former Republic Windows and Doors for 6 days until the major creditor, Bank of America, released $1.75 million in wages and benefits owed to workers. Republic sold the plant to Sirius, and workers celebrated as the first sit-down strike in years won a favorable settlement in the teeth of the Great Recession. This week's plant closing came with no warning. The union got a call from the boss that he wanted a meeting, but he wouldn't say why. Officers and UE staff were summoned to the offices of the notorious union-busting law firm Seyfarth and Shaw at 9 a.m. Thursday. Their executive said they would close the plant effective immediately. Workers would be put on leave while management dismantled the window-making machinery and shipped it to the company's other plants in Pennsylvania and Colorado. UE Regional President Carl Rosen called Sirius's CEO Kevin Cerace at headquarters in California and asked, "Do you really want to go this route? If it comes to it, we'll be dragged out and arrested." Leah Freed wondered if Sirius understood who they were dealing with. "These are people who won't take this lightly," she said. "They take this personally. They need jobs, and the political climate has changed. Now there's a whole Occupy movement that was inspired by us. We're sort of ground zero of Occupy." Meanwhile, local management called the police. A half dozen cops informed the workers they had 5 minutes to decide whether to leave peacefully or get arrested. They didn't make good on the threat, but they refused to let the pizzas ordered by Stand Up Chicago inside until a local pastor intervened, as local TV news cameras Let the workers eat, chanted the crowd. The cops backed off, but they wouldn't let anyone leave and then go back inside. By 5 p.m., a crowd had gathered outside. Occupy Chicago started to raise tents, showing how a culture to prepare and stick it out has developed since the last occupation. Freed said, the cold rain started to freeze. Negotiations shifted when corporate decision makers got on the phone. Management in California took over, apparently deciding they didn't want a big showdown. At 1 a.m., a tentative agreement was reached that met all of the workers' concerns. The plant will remain open, making windows for 90 days, and that's in writing. Sirius is committed to finding new ownership. Local union leaders are also interested in the possibility of a worker-run enterprise and are talking with consultants who specialize in converting factories to co-ops.
Wow, that's an interesting story. I mean, I guess Sirius Materials realized that the UE union was serious. And you know what really I think is interesting about that story is our very own Bob Pelesny interviewed the CEO of Sirius Materials right back in 2008, early 2009, when Sirius bought the Republic Windows and Doors. In fact, he contacted us and wanted to be interviewed on the Only World Labor Hour. So I thought, when I saw the story, I immediately thought about you because I wasn't here that Saturday when you interviewed him.
Yeah. You know, I mean, he had good intentions, we'll say. You know, but obviously things didn't work out for him. You know, the economy's not picking up as well as they had hoped. You know, housing starts are still not really picking up. But it seemed like they learned a little bit here from the Occupy Chicago people and the UE up there and stuff. You know, so they did have to back down. But they do have a couple other plants in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio, and I think they were talking about shifting most of the work there, but we'll see if they keep that plant open in Chicago.
Okay. Yeah, all right, Tom?
Walgreens will be expanding its presence in the local area with two more locations by taking over Christie Clinic's pharmacies. Clinic officials said a deal was signed earlier this month to sell Christie's two pharmacies, one at the main clinic in downtown Champaign and the other the Windsor Road branch, to Walgreens. The agreement calls for the Deerfield-based pharmacy chain to lease the spaces and keep both pharmacies open, doing some minor remodeling to give them more of a Walgreens look. Christie Clinic operates physician clinics in the cities of Champaign, Urbana, Danville, Mahomet, Rantoul, Tuscola, and Mattoon, but has never expanded its retail pharmacies beyond its two Champaign clinics. Christie Clinic's 22 pharmacy employees will get severance pay, but will also get interviews with Walgreens to get their jobs back. Walgreens also agreed to transfer the seniority levels of Christie Pharmacy employees who are rehired. The transfer of the business is expected to be completed by the end of March. Bob?
All right, thanks, Tom. In an open letter to Apple shareholders, the International Metal Workers Federation, the IMF, Good Electronics and Make It Fair declare the investigations of the Fair Labor Association, the FLA, at Apple supplier Foxconn to be a PR stunt. On February 23rd, the occasion of Apple's 2012 annual shareholders meeting, the IMF call on Apple shareholders to do the right thing in an open letter. Apple has recently joined the Fair Labor Association, but recent developments point to this being no more than a PR stunt. FLA is currently conducting an investigation of labor conditions at Apple supplier Foxconn in China. Although the FLA report is only due in March, it has already been reported that the FLA has formed a positive opinion of conditions at Foxconn without yet interviewing workers. This casts doubts on the independence of the investigation. FLA is directly funded by Apple, and the credibility of its final report. Contrary to FLA's standard methodology, the Foxconn investigation was not unannounced, which has allowed the company to hide abuses by banning illegal overtime for 16- and 17-year-olds during the period of the investigation.
Okay. Tom?
Hey, Archer Daniels Midland announced last week that they will be firing 175 people at their headquarters in Illinois as part of a plan to cut some 1,200 monthly salaried jobs across the company. The Decatur-based corporation said earlier this year that it planned to cut 1,000 jobs through layoffs and buyouts. The company would not provide statistics about where other cuts are happening, but it said it should be finished eliminating jobs in the U.S. by the end of this week, while elsewhere, outside the U.S., the process will continue. According to an ADM spokesperson, the company anticipates a total of about 1,200 job eliminations when they're done with the process in the coming months. ADM also reported that in addition to the 175 layoffs at its headquarters, 160 employees at the company's other locations in Decatur agreed to take buyouts. In all, the 335 lost jobs amount to about 8% of the company's 4,000 workers in the Decatur area.
Yeah, this is Bill here. And anyway, perhaps losing a job at ADM isn't that bad.
You know, they used to call ADM back in the 80s when they had a horrible safety record. ADM stood for another dead man.
Yeah, well, that's exactly what I was bringing up. I was working. Local listeners probably are familiar with the bridge over Route 50, or Interstate 57 with Monticello Road, where it goes over the
yes.
interstate there. Well. About 10 years ago, we were rebuilding that bridge, and basically we take it all the way apart. Mm-hmm. And for a good part of the job, you're walking on beams that are 8 inches wide over the traffic. And you're wearing a safety harness with a lanyard that stretches out up to 8 feet, and plus some sag in the cable that you're attached to. So if you fall, you better hope there's like no trucks coming.
Mm-hmm.
And
I worked on bridges. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Well, anyway, the company had a what we call a key man from their home local. And anyway, this guy was there. His dad was superintendent for another job for that company. And so he got this job because he used to work at ADM. And they thought that building bridges over interstates was safer than working at ADM.
No kidding.
Yes.
Oh, my gosh. That speaks volumes. Okay. We're going to go to a little Jim Hightower. We're going to be then back with Tom's poem, and then we're going to get right into our discussions with Gene Vanderport and Jim Ima about SDS in the current in the 60s and the current Occupy movement. So stay tuned.
In these times of cold health care austerity, it reaffirms one's faith in humanity to learn that many hospitals are now going the extra mile to provide top-quality care for all. For all super-rich people, that is. So rich that they can buy their way into amenities units that have quietly been built into secluded sections of many hospitals. It's not medical care that they're peddling to an elite clientele, but the personal pampering that the super-rich expect in all aspects of their lives. I was supposed to be in Buenos Aires last week taking tango lessons, a Wall Street executive explained matter-of-factly to a New York Times reporter, but unfortunately I hurt my back, so I'm here with my concierge. A hospital with a concierge? Yes, this one's called 11 West, an exclusive wing of New York's Mount Sinai Medical Center. We pride ourselves on getting anything the patient wants, beamed 11 West, director of hospitality. If they have a craving for lobster tails and we don't have them on the menu, we'll go out and get them. From New York to L.A., hospitals that draw huge subsidies from us taxpayers and often are so overcrowded that regular patients are lucky to get a gurney in the hallway have set aside entire floors for $2,400 a day deluxe suites. They come with butlers, five-star meals, marble baths, imported bed sheets, special kitchens, and other amenities for swells who have both insurance and cash to burn. This is Jim Hightower saying, not only is it repugnant for the plutocratic elite to pervert healthcare into a luxury commodity, but their very effort to do so splits asunder America's essential uniting principle of the common good. To push for a national policy that treats health care as a fundamental human need for all, contact Physicians for a National Health Program at pnhp.org. Let's take on what wall.
Okay, we now come to that portion of the program, the Labor Hour Cultural Corner, with Tom Thomas's brand new poem of the week, What Recovery? Tom?
Some say there is a recovery enveloping the land around. That is a claim that is untrue, for all around the poor are found. The rich are getting richer still, while all the poor barely survive. The rich can afford medical care. The poor are lucky to stay alive. How can it be recovery when the deepest of wounds don't heal? How much more of the nation's wealth can all the crooked bankers steal? How do you tell a hungry soul there's not a slice of bread to eat? How do you explain to children why they have to live in the street? Our nation needs a government that is not a Wall Street business, a representative government that's for the people and no less. Our land has the ability to feed and to house everyone, because ours is the greatest land that's ever been under the sun. Remember that election day and try to get some statesmen in who may bring light to our darkness if the people finally win. What Recovery was written at the Poets Loft in Champaign, Illinois on February 19, 2012, and was brought to you live today, February 25, 2012, here on the Illinois World Labor Hour on WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign, community radio for East Central Illinois.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Some public service announcements. Tune in tomorrow, Sunday, and every Sunday from 4 to 5 p.m. for Labor's World View TV with hosts Jim Iman and yours truly. And if any of you got the email announcement I sent out about the program about SDS that we taped yesterday, it was supposed to be playing this Sunday with Gene Vanderport and Jim Iman, I want to send my apologies. That program is not going to be aired until next Sunday. So in its place, we're playing an oldie but goodie, which I think will make up for this somewhat, and it's called The Children's March. Birmingham, 1963, a very inspirational film about getting arrested and going to jail in mass numbers and driving the authorities crazy. I mean, it's an extremely exceptional film. So tune into that tomorrow from 4 to 5 p.m. on Comcast Channel 6, Labor's Worldview TV, The Children's March, Birmingham, 1963. And also coming up Saturday, March 10th at 1 p.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, there's going to be a Flexingate Workers Speak Out. And that's going to be quite an event. There's going to be workers speaking out about their conditions at Flexingate, that's owned by a local billionaire, Rashid Khan, who, even though he's a billionaire, doesn't seem to be able to afford safety equipment and safe health working conditions at the plant. So definitely we'll be announcing that next week and the following week as well. But again, mark your calendars for Saturday, March 10th, 1 p.m. at Channing Murray Foundation, Flexingate Workers Speak Out. And also coming up down the road, something really fun and exciting, Mitch Daniels, the governor of Indiana, is going to be in Champaign at the local Champaign County Republican dinner. And that's going to be on April 19th. There's going to be quite a welcoming reception for Mitch Daniels by the local unions and other community organizations. And that's at the Hilton Gardens on the corner of Neal, South Neal, and Kirby. And we'll keep you posted on that. But people are going to be turning out about 4 p.m. for that. And it's going to be, I think, quite a party. So you definitely want to mark that one on your calendars. Come on out and let's give Mitch Daniels a warm reception. Gene, did you have anything to comment on that?
No, I did.
Okay.
They even had a flyer for it at flyers at the Laborers Hall.
Well, yeah, I would like to compliment the building trades on this. Well, I won't go there, but nevertheless, let's just say that I'm very proud that the building trades has actually has taken a very proactive move on this and wanting to do something.
People from Laborers have been over the last year in Indiana at protests.
Good.
Dan McCall was exquisite in what he was talking about. I mean, it was good. He did a good job.
Okay, well, good.
Worked for his dad once.
We'll give credit where credit's due. So I want to, again, compliment the building trades for this great idea, very proactive, and plenty of time to mobilize, that's for sure. So,
Don't forget, like, April 19th has been a very auspicious date in history. It's
really?
It's Hitler's birthday.
Oh, how appropriate.
And you might remember that little thing, that little bombing in Oklahoma City.
Are you kidding? That was April 19th, too?
Yeah, so it's really weird that they kind of picked this date. It's maybe sort of like Reagan giving his announcement for running in Philadelphia. You know, that type of a message. I don't know.
Okay. All right.
I have to make some connections with our posters.
Yeah. And I'm at Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the people were killed.
Oh, yeah. The civil rights workers
were murdered. Yeah.
Okay.
The other city of brotherly love.
Yeah, supposedly. Okay. I'd like to welcome to the show today Gene Vanderport and Jim Iman. So I guess, guys, why don't you introduce yourselves? We'll start with Gene.
Start with me?
Yes.
I'm Gene Vanderport. Is this thing working right? Okay, anyway. I'm with the Central Illinois Coalition for Jobs with Justice, and I've been active on the teachers' movement and the educational employees' movement, and I've been a socialist since 1965.
Okay, Jim Iman here. United Transportation Union Local 1382, retired trainman, Milwaukee Road and Sioux Line. I've got with me today Gene and Pat, both of whom are veterans of the SDS, the Students for a Democratic Society.
Yes.
David?
Okay. Well, great. Let's see. Where do we want to start this off at? I know yesterday we filmed the TV show that'll be airing a week from this Sunday. My fault there. Mi culpa. So let's start off. Why don't you talk about when you first started getting you first got involved with SDS, Students for a Democratic Society?
It was 1964, and I wanted to volunteer as a sophomore from Westville High School with two other comrades, Tom DeQuimple and Lloyd Wiseman. All three of us wanted to get active because, you know, we're watching Mario Savio did the free speech movement. We're watching all this stuff happening, all on TV, quite frankly, with the civil rights movement. And all of a sudden, we want to get active. We want to do something to make a difference. And believe it or not, New Republic ran a series about the Students for a Democratic Society. And they came up with this concept called, a maximum individual participation and democratic control of decisions affect your lives and the resources on which you're dependent sounded like a really good idea. It sounded like something very different. It wasn't just about voting. It was about controlling everything in your life with a democratic vote. Well, I got kind of enthused. And SDS was this place where other folks were getting enthused about that same concept. I got sucked in, and here I am 40, 50 years later.
I think instead of telling you when I got started, I think people out there that are listening, you really don't know when SDS got started or really what it was all about. So I'm going to give you a brief history, and then we can catch up with our own experiences. Gene and I have been at this since yesterday and having really a lot of fun with it. We didn't realize we were at the same place at the same time many times.
Yeah.
And Pat, I just learned today, was a member of SDS. So anyway, the Students for a Democratic Society was founded in 1962 and didn't really organize until 63 when Tom Hayden became president with Paul Booth, the VP. And Jim Monsouris is the national secretary. SNCC's first statement was at Port Huron, Michigan, where Tom Hayden got three dozen people or so together to make a draft, which really turned out to be the a statement of views and construction for a new left in America. And SDS's paper went on to be called New Left Notes. Now, I was an old leftist, being a member of the Young Socialist Alliance. So anyway, Hayden didn't last very long, but while he was there and afterward, the main inspiration for SDS wasn't the war in Vietnam, it was racism, mainly. And we were very, very taken with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and there was a period where, Carl Oglesby actually took over right after Hayden. Hayden didn't last very long.
Right.
And Oglesby was a really, he was a speaker like Mario Savio was in the free speech movement. Very powerful and commanding.
Right.
And his work, I think, led up finally to the, in 1965, to the March on Washington, which was the first mass march that SDS had created. And Oglesby gave the keynote address, and referring to the United States as an imperialist power, and that got the attention of the press and the police and everyone else, and that at least SDS was now being covered after the otherwise it was, you know, blackout. David, did you want to just make a...
Yeah, I was just going to then ask Pat then when you got involved with SDS.
Well, actually, I got involved a bit later at Northern Illinois University. And my particular interest by that point was more in terms of its anti-war stance. Although I do remember that the first meeting I went to, I was just generally a kind of innocent young woman who was actually more involved at the time in the Newman Club, which gives you some sense of where I was coming from, and went to the first meeting because I was interested in the war and what was going on in Vietnam, et cetera, and got to the meeting, and the chair of the meeting talked about having a moment of silence for a dead comrade, Che Guevara, who had just been killed in Bolivia and trying to advance the cause of revolution there. And I remember at the moment, and very clearly stating that they considered him a communist, small c, and I thought, oh my goodness, these are communists here. And then I thought, but you know, they seem to be on the right side of these issues. And so I continued to participate at that point. But it is interesting. It's a bit later. And so in a sense, though I certainly became aware of the anti-racist position of SDS, my initial engagement was in terms of the position on the war.
Yes. Well, getting back to Che Guevara's assassination, since you brought it up, the CIA has pretty much been indicted for that. But I have some questions on this, without going into it. Because Che did not want to go along with Fidel. He told Fidel that building industry and agriculture on the Soviet system is going to be a total failure. And he also wanted to go out and expand the revolution, which he did. And by going to Bolivia and then to Peru and back in that area, organizing, he was already known. His first contacts were the Bolivian Communist Party, you know, in La Paz and elsewhere. And I just think he was sold out, to be honest with you. He just wasn't going to go along with it. The Soviet system. Frankly, I think he was a closet Trotskyist. But.
Okay, Gina, so kind of a little background, SDS and stuff. So you got involved kind of early on when you were a sophomore in high school, and that was mainly because of the civil rights battle. And at that time, the war in Vietnam was just starting up. Is that correct?
Well, actually, I got involved before Trotsky was born. Anyway, well, you know... Yeah, it was the civil rights thing that just got our attention. You know, the voters' rights thing that was happening in the South. And here I was, this Quaker kid, and I just wanted to go South. I was 15. I wanted to go South. I wanted to go register people to vote. But then my mom said, they're killing kids your age down there. You better not do that. And so I had to change my orientation a little bit. But nonetheless, I was raised by good, union mine workers, and had an uncle who, well, let me just tell you the truth. Not many people know that the Communist Party's general secretary actually was underground in Georgetown, Illinois for a few weeks, okay, at my uncle's house. I didn't know who Eugene Dennis was. He's a nice guy. But Eugene Dennis was in Georgetown, Illinois.
Wait, the Communist Party USA?
Yeah, that's the same one.
That's the same party that is now a staunch supporter of Barack Obama?
Well, listen, let's not go there.
Has
okay?
things changed a little bit?
Well, yes. Anyway, okay, let's not go there. We don't want to fight over that.
I don't think we should either.
Anyway, but the point is, I mean, these folks... They were good union organizers. United Mill and Smelter workers, right? I mean, those guys were great organizers. And actually, my uncle was drummed out of being a vice president because he was not in the CPUSA. He was probably farther to the left. He was an IWW guy. He actually heard Big Bill Haywood speak. My uncle heard him speak. Why? This is where we came from. You know, it's Terre Haute, Eugene Debs. I mean, all these folks came up from this part of the world. And so I was just blessed to be around long enough to be around some of these old folks.
Okay, so now, so I'll give a little background here, what was going on at the time. You had the civil rights, of course, you know, I was a very small kid at this time in grade school, you know, but I remember, you know, seeing these dramatic scenes on television of black people being beaten and fire hosed and, you know, dogs being turned on them and stuff. And so this is kind of the background that SDS was born, if you will, because of that outrage over how African Americans were treated in the South and throughout other parts of the country as well. And then about this time that, you know, you guys got involved, was just the start of the Vietnam War, the LBJ and stuff. So I guess then now we want to go to Jim, and I understand, Jim, you were a member at large, but you came kind of out of Milwaukee. Just talk about how you first got involved with SDS and kind of what you did a little bit.
All right. Well, my history was at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and I joined the Young Socialist Alliance. Now, this was in 1961. Now, in 1962, then, SDS was formed, but we hadn't heard about it and weren't for a couple of years at Madison, which...
No internet at that time.
Yeah, right. Crank telephones.
All we had was a New Republic.
Mimeograph machines. Seriously. I know how to operate them. Anyway... at the time that I was in Madison, the anti-war movement was just starting. Now, in 62 and 61, this was just a police action. But I think we were actually at the forefront of the anti-war movement in Madison. And later it went to Berkeley. Jane, did you have a comment on that?
That's absolutely true.
Yeah,
no, that's true.
Right. And, you know, coming out of high school, remember I went to the Green Lanning Eating Co-op, so you had to work put some hours in, and then you got real cheap meals.
Yeah,
because they had to. But anyway, I remember everybody in there was a lefty. It was like the Shackmanites had one, the table, the CPers another, the Young Communist League people, and the Young Socialists. You know, and it just was like. It was kind of culture shock for me, to be honest with you, and the socialist forum had about 203 members. There were only two of us from Wisconsin, and about 80% of them were from either Brooklyn Science or Brooklyn Hunter High School. But so, I mean, true red diaper babies.
Yeah.
But nevertheless. You know, it was a fast education for me. I was sort of like getting thrown into the cauldron, and one of the first demonstrations against the war was in Madison, and SDS also called the student strike in Madison and Milwaukee against the invasion of Cambodia, which I was seriously involved in.
Yes.
Okay, I want to open up the phone lines here. Anyone wants to call in, ask any questions of our guests, 359-5483. But it looks like we've already got somebody called in. Gene, the station manager just handed you a little note there.
Yes. Colonel Esterbrook just corrected the entire history of the world as he normally does.
Way to go, Carl.
And he's absolutely right. It was the anarchists who started SDS. It was Paul Goodman, those kinds of influences on us. I was an anarchist syndicalist until I figured out, maybe there's something more. Here's when I stopped being an anarchist. It was a four-way stop on Kirby and Lincoln. And we couldn't figure out who should go next. Well, you know what? Sometimes somebody's got to go. So I became, I went from anarchism to Leninism at a four-way stop by Florida Residence Hall.
Okay, this is from Wikipedia. Origins of the SDS. The SDS developed from the Student League for Industrial Democracy, the youth branch of a socialist educational organization known as the League for Industrial Democracy, which descended from the Intercollegiate Socialist Society, started in 1905.
Right. Oh, wow. So that goes back. So anyway, but nevertheless, I mean, this is kind of real interesting. And Pat, you wanted to say something real quick?
I also just want to mention, because I think partly what we were also going to talk about today is some of the parallels between SDS and the Occupy movement today. And it's interesting because as you even hear this discussion about what were the real origins of SDS, like the Occupy movement, it seems to me that what we're talking about is a movement that basically came out of many different strands.
Correct.
The other thing I think that's really important about the parallels is what Gina talked about in terms of the notion of direct democracy, maximum participation. And certainly this is what, as somebody who's been writing about Occupy says, is an important element in what the General Assemblies are trying to do and, or as they say, prefigure the kind of society that we're interested in looking at. So,
Pat, that was a very excellent tie-in, a synopsis. That was great. So, you know what, on that note, I think we're going to take a real quick musical break here, and we're going to be back to kind of make some of those tie-ins with the current Occupy movement. You know, probably a little bit more on the history of SDS here and there. And do you have a video, an audio segment with Fred Hampton?
Yeah.
Okay, we got to play that too. So we'll be right back. This is Tom Morello playing here, and we'll be back shortly.
I hurt the gentlest souls. I robbed my wife and son. I turned my back on troubles, troubles I'd begun. I cut a swath of pain and loss in the hallways of my home. In the quiet of my room, I know the things I've done. Save the hammer for the man. Save the hammer for the man. It's the calling of the wretched, it's the rising of the damned. Save the hammer for the man.
I was driven from the city, in the wilderness I stand. In the cleansing rain and silence, I made my battle plan. Alone I marched towards freedom, leaving footprints across the land. With a vow that's left unspoken, save the hammer for the man.
Okay, that was Tom Morello off his Worldwide Rebel Songs, and that one was called Save the Hammer for the Man. So we're back here, Pat made an excellent tie-in transition there at the end before the music break. I think we want to pick it up from there. And just a real quick little background, SDS came out of a turmoil in American and world society at this point. In that case, in those days, it was first the civil rights struggle and then the Vietnam War. Now, we fast forward to years later, the Occupy movement. They came out, of course, this was now it's a wars with an S as well, and severe economic dislocation, extreme income inequality.
And guess what? Racism still is not gone.
No. Even though we have an African-American president. But nevertheless, the corporate power has consolidated its stranglehold on democracy and the people. So here we are now. So let's maybe start there with the Occupy movement. Of course, we know all this. It's recent of why they're there. But I guess we needed to go about how it functions. I mean, as far as creating a new society with the old, and let's start with Jim.
All right. Where we got to go is a resistance movement, and this is what Occupy is all about. It's a resistance to everything that's going on, continually lower wages, busting of unions, inability of students to pay debts or even get a job when they get out of high school. It is a resistance movement, and the organizational methodology that SDS used was very similar to what the Occupy movement used. They wanted first of all, there's a system of consensus. And it was one of the things I think that was a real problem in SDS. Because it's rather than taking a vote, you have to have everybody has to agree. And, I mean, I hate to say this, but Utah Phillips, one of my heroes, wants to find a camel as a horse drawn or designed by a consensus committee. And there's an element of truth to this. You know, you can sit around and never come to a consensus, or you can take a vote and solve a lot of time. Everybody doesn't have to agree.
I think where we have to go is, you got empty factories, we have to occupy those factories. You got empty school rooms, you got to occupy those school rooms. You got laid off teachers, you got to call them back. That's where you got to go. Let's occupy all the places of production in terms of services, thought, and anything else. Occupy that. That's where we got to go. I don't care about occupying not one more street. I want to occupy the things that matter.
It's interesting because I've been thinking about this a lot. I have been participating to some extent in the local Occupy. And one of the things that actually, in some ways, I think Occupy has a certain advantage in terms of mobilizing a mass movement. And what I mean by that is that, as opposed to SDS, and we have yet to get to talking about the developments and the evolution of the Weathermen and what that meant for SDS or didn't mean, as the case may be, but I think that what's really important to emphasize is that, yes, there was a terrible war, the Vietnam War, in that period of time. Yes, there was racism, terrible racism in the country. Both of those things are still with us. But the fact was that in that period of time, there wasn't as much potential discontent among white working class workers as we have today because of the terrible economic crisis.
Brilliant, Pat. You're absolutely right. And part of the problem was, too, is that the it was very difficult to get any of the unions support the anti-war movement. The United Industrial, or the UE did, United Electrical Workers, and a couple of others. But that was it, because the AFL-CIO bureaucracy is so married to the Democratic Party that as long as Lyndon Johnson was in, they weren't going to say a word. That all changed when Nixon was elected, however.
Yeah, well, I want to say as a younger person here that the impression that I was given through the media, I think me and Dave are the same age. Yeah. I was 10 years old.
You went to school with my son.
Yeah. But I was 10 years old in 1966, give you some perspective.
I was 10 in 67. So,
okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, what it seemed to me that all these – that the union people were these guys in hard hats that beat up hippie anti-war protesters. You know, so I think really the union shot themselves in the foot at doing what they did at that time. And they've done the same thing now with another Democrat in the White House.
Okay, I think maybe we should move here real quick into kind of one of the – now, SDS had a lot – I mean, they they had so many – I mean, first it started out with small numbers, but then, you know, by, I think, 68, I mean, they had so many people wanting to join up that they didn't know what to do. I mean, it was –
100,000 people.
Yes, and so, I mean, it was – but then later on, there was a rift in SDS, and I guess – let's see. Gene, do you want to talk a little about that? And, of course, we can do a round robin here with Pat and Jim.
It was the worst day of my life, okay? Mm-hmm. It was when part of our best folks – and I got to say this. I mean, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Darn, and they're good, great people. They came from a different place than some of the rest of us, and they were more...
What do you mean by that, exactly?
Their class.
Saying they weren't working class?
I'm going to say it, there was a class distinction. Okay. Bill Ayers comes from ComEd, and Bernadine came from the labor lawyer folks, and the rest of us were like, how the heck do you connect up with the man and the woman and the kids next door? How are you going to organize? And so they're saying, well, we're going to go pick up the gun. And I, honest to God, I said this to Bill Ayers that we're going out this last convention door. I said, what sea are you going to swim in? What sea are you going to swim in?
And you mean that by the quote from Mao Zedong about that
the people are the sea.
Exactly right. If the people aren't ahead of you, then what the heck are you going to do picking up the gun? Made no sense to us.
Okay. Pat, do you have that audio segment ready here? This is Fred Hampton, who used to be chairman of the Black Panther Party in Chicago, about his take on the break-off from SDS of the Weathermen. Push the aux button. Okay.
Now click on it.
All right.
The Weatherman SDS has been trying to give the impression that the Black Panthers are on their side, but the Panthers deny this.
We believe that the Weatherman action is anarchistic, opportunistic, individualistic, it's chauvinistic, it's custeristic, and that's the bad part about it. It's custeristic in that its leaders take people into situations where the people can be massacred, and they call it revolution, and it's nothing but child's play, it's folly. We think these people may be sincere, but they're misguided, they're muddleheads, and they're scatterbrained.
Okay, we're back. That was short, Pat. I guess that kind of sums it up. Would you guys disagree with that statement from Fred Hampton?
Can I just say this real quick?
Yeah.
It was Fred who came to the SDS convention and said, kill one cop, you get some satisfaction. Kill two cops, you get more satisfaction. Kill three cops, you get even that more satisfaction. So we looked around at each other and said, he's going to be dead soon. 2 weeks later, he was dead.
He was actually murdered by the Chicago police. While he was sleeping in bed.
Yes. In cooperation with the FBI.
Yes, indeed. But okay, that's a kind of little interesting segment here. Now let's go back to the Occupy movement of today. Let's start with Pat this time. Okay,
I wanted to say something, Dave.
Oh yeah, go ahead, Bill.
Well, what I wanted to bring up, which I would have talked about last week, but we had something else happening, is Chris Hedges, who's become a quite prominent writer. He last week wrote a big column about the Black Bloc, whatever
the Black Bloc is.
The Black Bloc is they came to prominence in the 1999 World Trade Organization Battle of Seattle Teamsters and Turtles demonstration. It's cliche on the left. And anyway, he. The Black Bloc, or they're supposedly anarchists. And what's happened is David Graeber, who is also thought of as a leading intellectual light of the Occupy movement, who's a Black Bloc participant in the past, was explaining how they aren't all anarchists, and there's not always what the Black Bloc presence is. Is just a group of people who would be willing to go the extra steps.
Which and means basically fighting back the police instead of just passively being beaten.
Right, and there's also, and the term that's being bandied about quite a bit now in this milieu is diversity of tactics, and how it lends itself to the non-hierarchical aspect of the Occupy movement and so on and so forth.
Okay. And Chris Hedges actually came out and attacked the. I mean, it's not just Chris Hedges. There seemed to be like there was a kind of a current going on for a while.
Well, see, what's
interesting. To try to basically make or manipulate the Occupy movement to expel anybody who was associated with the Black Bloc and to disavow their tactics and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right, yeah, and on the other side, it's coming up about the peace police, where you have actually one protester physically restraining other protesters. So it's a bit of a sticky wicket. Okay. Yeah.
I don't want to get necessarily at this point into the issue of specific tactics, narrowly speaking, in terms of do you respond to police violence, et cetera, and in what fashion. What I do want to talk about, and I think it's important to be careful about labels here, but there is a tendency, and I've seen this in talking to people in the Occupy movement, that I think parallels some of the problems of the Weathermen, particularly as epitomized in the famous Days of Rage, a sort of notion of revolution that would occur almost spontaneously, and that, as a matter of fact, what the Days of Rage was about was, well, we'll all go out, we'll start throwing rocks, et cetera, and there's going to be this massive upswelling of people that are going to, go along with this, and this will lead necessarily to revolution in the United States. Well, I think that's a very naive view. It certainly was proved to be very naive in terms of what happened in the Days of Rage. And I think there's somewhat of that element within the Occupy movement. And I guess what I would say is the problem is there is no substitute for organizing. There never will be a substitute for organizing. Things do not happen spontaneously. Whether you want to call it revolution, whether you want to call it profound structural reform, it does not happen without organizing. And that means, I think, to some extent, Occupy has to reach out.
Thank you, Pat. You've taken the words right out of my mouth. But
as Gene was talking about the sea, what Occupy needs to do is create the sea that they can swim in as revolutionaries.
Yes. From Chairman Mao. Yes.
And Chairman Gene Mao.
From Westville, Illinois.
Oh, Gene. well, we've been having a lot of fun with this, but I think with the little bit of time we have left, we should get critical about the end of SDS. After the 69 convention in Chicago.
That you and Gene both were at, right?
That both of us were at the Chicago Coliseum. It seriously went down. That's where they formally split into the Revolutionary Youth Movement and the Workers' Student Alliance. The beginnings of that came in the previous year in 68, just over tactics and strategies. And the Workers' Student Alliance continued for a long time until about 74, but they converted over to International Committees Against Racism because there were Canadian chapters. But that was what happened. Now, you can't always stop a division in an organization from happening. There were too many divergent ideas. We should be concentrating on splitting up the Democratic Party today rather than ourselves. I think that would be the biggest contribution that the Occupy movement could make.
Okay, Gene, you mentioned that what you think would be great for the Occupy movement to kind of take the next step is to actually start occupying abandoned factories, abandoned buildings for housing, start up production, kind of like what they did in Argentina after the economic collapse. Okay, now in addition to that, do you see a role for, like, say, an Occupy political party? Let's say, I mean, I'm a carpenter, so I have a lot of tools in my toolbox, and I have no preferences for one or the other. It depends on whatever's best for the job at hand.
Well, let me just say this. Yes. The whole thing that we have to get is that we have to occupy the places of production, we have to occupy the payments, and we have to occupy the polls. We have to do all those things. It's electoral, it's production, it's about the culture and the society we make. It's all of those things. What the heck was that? Apparently, I said something that was really too far to the left.
But you're talking about Chicago Convention. I got the part one of Medium Cool here on YouTube.
Oh, Medium Cool. Yeah. One of my favorite movies.
Right. Okay, well, on this, you know, the Workers' Student Alliance published a pamphlet, you know, Who Are the Bombers? Because they had to divest themselves from what the weathermen were doing. Sure. Not that they killed anybody.
Oh, yeah, dude.
The only people they killed were themselves.
They killed themselves.
At the townhouse in New York, and they disappeared after that. You know, kids, if you want to make a bomb, you know, talk to the IRA, you know, or the Anarchist Cookbook. You know, there's no excuse for blowing yourself up.
Or mine workers from Westville.
Yeah.
Yeah. A criticism that I've. That I've kind of had of the Black Bloc is, okay, so you go out and you break some windows and you kind of endanger a lot of other people that are generally in the same location, in the same protest, invite the reaction, you know, more reaction. Why don't you go out and what I'm looking at or suggesting, the idea I have would be more like the ALF. And the ELF, the Animal and Earth Liberation Fronts, who actually go out and do actions. They rescue animals. They burn down offending ski lodges and housing developments rather than just going out and breaking the window at the real estate office.
Yeah, we're not advocating on the only way labor hour, of course. All
no,
we're
no, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah,
is, we're the black blocks.
Just to clarify, we're doing analysis here. And Pat, I'm going to let you kind of have the last, or unless Jim has. Okay, Jim, one more statement, then I'll have Pat do a final statement.
Oh, yes. My favorite quotation from Daniel DeLeon is, "With the workers, we use cold logic. With the bourgeoisie, hot lead."
Oh,
Pat?
Okay. Well, I guess I also just want to close on a note of more optimism in terms of the Occupy movement. Let's face it, folks, it still has been an extraordinary phenomenon that has changed the debate in the United States in a way that nothing has within the last 30 or so years, and give a lot of the people involved in it a great deal of credit. And also just to offer what I think today really amount to words of caution, very serious caution about certain directions that might be taken.
Okay.
One thing that I like about the local Occupy movement that's different from what I've seen of other Occupy movements is their weekly practice of occupying an intersection, somewhere where they can get out to the people. Hopefully someday we'll start canvassing neighborhoods and really hitting people.
Yes, that would be great. Okay, you've been listening to the Illinois World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio in East Central Illinois. I want to thank Gene.